Support for the Commodity Week podcast comes from Strategic Farm Marketing in Champaign with crop insurance, grain marketing, and commodity brokerage services. Learn more at sfarmmarketing.com. And by ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
This is the April 22nd edition of Commodity Week.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Welcome to Commodity Week. I am Todd Gleason. This is a special edition. Our guest today, Joe Persaki of USDA NASS, will join us in the second half of the program. Our panelists in studio today include Bill Gentry of Risk Management Commodities out of Lafayette, Indiana, Mike Georgie from Allendale in Mahomet, Illinois, and Greg Johnson of the Andersons from right here in Champaign County. Here are the way the numbers settled in Chicago Thursday afternoon, the last trading day of the week. Remember, we give you the daily high, low, and settlement price for the week, all week long, overnight and day trade, electronic, and open outcry. May wheat futures at a high on the week at $8.08, a low at $7.40, and settled $7.99, up 55¼ cents from last week. The July at 8.34¾ finished 54¾ higher in Chicago's soft red winter wheat pit. Corn futures finished the May contract with a top of $7.68, a bottom at $7.28½, and settled at $7.37¼, a loss this week of 4¾ cents, but December futures gained 9½ to settle at $6.65½. May soybeans at $13.82 on the top side, the bottom at $13.20¾, a settlement price at $13.80½, up 48¾. And November soybeans, the new crop at $13.82½, finished 42¾ higher. April live cattle futures finished at $118.40 per 100 pounds, up a buck on the week. April feeders at $132.27½, were up 12½ cents. And the May lean hog futures this week finished at $102.05. They were down 37½ cents. In a moment, we'll continue Commodity Week right here on this radio station. Commodity Week is a production of Illinois Public Media. You can always find us online at willag.org.
Support for Commodity Week comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333. And by ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
Our panelists in studio on this April 22nd edition of Commodity Week include Bill Gentry, Mike Georgie, and Greg Johnson. Greg, let's start with you. Farmers have not been in the field the past several days. Good portion of last week. Doesn't look like they'll be in it next week either. Have they been calling you very often, and what else are they doing?
Well, that's exactly what they're doing. They're calling in and asking why the markets aren't going up every day. They say, don't the people in Chicago realize that the forecast is wet this week, wet next week, and wet for the foreseeable future? And, you know, they just don't quite understand why the market doesn't go up every day. And, you know, it's our job, I guess, to explain to them that there's other factors besides just the weather, although that is a very important one.
Bill Gentry?
Yeah, I think the factors are changing day by day, and they've been influenced by the headline risk of the international community for several weeks. And now that we're turning into a weather market that changes every day, they're just really searching for answers in an environment that's kind of void of them.
And Mike Georgie?
Yeah, I think what Bill and Greg said is true, but you know, they're ready to get out in the field. They've got some field work done before all this rain, but they're definitely anxious why the markets aren't going higher. But they're ready to roll, and I think they're going to start rolling probably quicker than they should. But we're definitely going to try to get this in a timely manner.
Greg, you said they were asking you why it went down. In fact, May corn was off 4 3/4 cents on the week. What factors do you think were involved in that?
I think there's some profit taking taking place. I mean, we did make new contract highs in the new crop corn this week. So beans were higher, both old crop and new crop. Wheat was higher. So most of the commodities were higher this week. It's just old crop corn. And, you know, a lot of that's a function of the speculators getting in and out of that spread, that old crop, new crop spread. So I'm not too concerned. I still think there's higher prices to come. But it just, you know, it's a long-term process. Every day-to-day, it's hard to explain day-to-day moves.
Bill Gentry?
Yeah, certainly. I do think it is that relationship between the old crop, new crop spread. There has been some money movement into the market at times, and now they're kind of picking their choice and saying December's probably the safest play for the time being until we get the cash to tighten up a little bit and see a better play in the bases.
That's a speculator move, relatively speaking. What should a producer be doing?
At this particular point in time, producers should probably be laying out a little bit of cash sales for fall, both corn and beans, and on the side notes too, when on the up days, maybe pick up a few puts too.
Do you agree with him?
I think that's right. I think you've got to get something on, whatever it be, options, futures. Do some hedging. I don't know if I'd regular sell cash, but I think I'd use the futures to put in a bottom and hopefully leave the top side open.
How much upside potential do the three of you think there might be in this marketplace for corn? And then if you could take up beans, too, because I'm not sure that you'll be as excited about that crop.
Well, I think corn could get to 690 is what we're looking at. And, you know, if we get continued bad weather, I mean, that's just a step to go higher. But, I mean, we're looking at 690 as a good possibility. Beans, I think if you get back to $14, you have to make some sales and get it protected at that level.
That 14 level for beans sounds pretty good, or maybe even a touch higher. It's not yet defined as far as what the real upside potential is, because we haven't seen that first hardcore spook and really challenge the shorts in the market. But in simple numbers, I'd say the 835 and 845 would be a target for old crop, just shy of $7 for new crop. But I don't know that that's going to happen, you know, next week or even 2 weeks from now. It may take something a little bit further down the road.
Yeah, I think the bean market has the potential, you know, even though we may plant more acres, to really be volatile. So I haven't always been a big fan of options, but this may be the year where farmers need to look at options. I mean, you can look at buying a $14 put, locking in a floor, and then maybe selling a $17, $18 call, because, you know, beans can go that high. You know, with the weak dollar, with the China demand, all we have to do is look back to last year. We had an excellent bean crop, and look where the prices went because of Chinese demand.
Chinese demand, but when you take a look at the numbers that came from USDA in the April report, it showed what appears to be rationing in the bean market had started at some time earlier in the year. Darrell Good has told us as early as last November.
Yes, there has been some, but from what levels? I mean, we were at some pretty lofty levels, and who's to say now that China hasn't depleted their reserves? They still haven't bought corn, and they may need to add to those beans too. They have a 5% inflation over there. Food is hard to come by. You know, if they've depleted their reserves, about their only recourse is to import grains.
When you look at the meal and the oil side of the beans, those products, are you worried about oil usage at all?
Not oil usage right now. I think that was the driving force early on. But about 2 weeks ago, there was a little bit of a perk pop in the meal. And I think what's happened is the slowing crush pace has left the meal inventory a little bit light, and the livestock consumer or livestock guys need some of that. And I think both products, if you looked at them early on today, both of them were catching a bid. The oil was following the crude, and the meal market's catching a bid probably from the livestock sector.
Now, in the livestock sector, and we can talk about this as it relates to inputs, both meal, oil, and then corn, the inventory's there to continue to purchase all those crops at relatively high levels, and can they make money? I mean, they finished it. $132, and the feeder cattle, live cattle, $118. Hogs were $102 at the end of the week.
The margins seem to be relatively good, and I think the inventories are small enough, and the American consumer still wants their steak. So even if the price goes up, you know, 10 or 15 or 20%, there's still going to be a market for it. So, yeah, the herds are small enough, and the consumer will probably pay the price.
Yeah, I think the producer is making money at these levels. What we see is, especially in the nearby cattle, June cattle, we think could get down to 106 just because of the high inputs we had into the feedlots last November, December, January. They'll be coming out. After that, we have very low numbers again. Hog numbers now, we're at a low point of the year. We think they could go higher. So other than a lull right here in this next couple months, everything looks good for prices to stay higher.
If I'm understanding right, I'm hearing that the export market, for beans anyway, may be pretty good. For the corn market, it's slacked off, but everybody seemed to think that exports for corn going to stay pretty decent too, right? Yes. And
yes.
Then everybody's saying livestock sector, hey, it's in the game. Greg, that only leaves ethanol.
and you have to remember that, ethanol producers understand that, if the market is trending higher, they use these breaks. And we had a dollar break in corn about 3, 4, 5 weeks ago, somewhere in there. A lot of the ethanol producers and livestock feeders use that break as an opportunity to get 3 to 4 months worth of coverage on the books. So, yeah, I don't know where the cutback is going to come from until we just force the price so much higher that it's just going to force people to, defer demand from old crop to new crop.
So I've heard this several times, and the thought is, well, we probably on that break, if everybody was thinking properly, got themselves covered till June, that leaves us July and August, which either usually is a big-time move to the upside or it drops the bottom out of the thing for corn. Which is it going to be this year?
I think there's still more upside than downside.
And that's part of the logic why the next round is going to be a lot more difficult for the end user to procure. So we've even begun starting to put our positions a little bit further out, maybe even looking at the September idea, because that's where the tightness looks like it's going to develop, at least at this point. Both livestock guys and the ethanol guys, from what we gather, are covered through June, and some of them even into a good chunk of July. So that makes that window a little bit further out.
That's very true. I agree with both of them. It's going to tighten up. Demand seems to be good for corn. I mean, with beans, I worry if they quit buying from us, there's a heck of a lot of beans in South America. Argentina and Brazil keep increasing their bean crops. What's to stop them? I mean, I still feel the reason we've gone up in the beans is because of demand of China. And if they quit us, there's no more demand out there from anybody else.
Greg, last time around, the United States Department of Agriculture said, hey, we think ethanol usage this marketing year is going to be bigger than it was. So 5 billion bushels is the number. Two things. One, can they make that? And two, we haven't talked about the elephant in the room, which is the crude oil market and the lack maybe thereof of usage for gasoline in the United States and the impact it might have.
Well, in 2008, we didn't run out of oil either, and prices went to $148 a barrel. Why was that? It was because of speculation. And with low, low, low interest rates, I think the government is encouraging people that have money to put their money in hard commodities. So I think there's still more speculation to come, and that's going to push prices higher, even though the physical demand for oil could be lower. So I still see higher prices.
And higher prices for crude, and I'll come back to you and get the second part of that question. Does that mean that we'll shrink usage for gasoline and, by default, shrink usage for ethanol?
I think that's yet to be determined in this economic environment. I mean, we're a third of the way through the year, and the consumers are just now getting pinched with the $4-plus gasoline prices. I think it's a possibility that it could constrict some consumption, but we've already been pretty lean, and the demand has continued to grow, and ethanol could still be a little bit of a less expensive substitute.
Are you worried about inflation very much at this point?
Not at this point. I think the government's going to keep things down. They want to keep things down, and at this point, I don't think we are.
What tells you that that's going to be the case? I mean, you say the government wants to keep it down.
Well, they want to keep the money cheap. They don't want inflation because they want jobs to they want to create jobs, and they're not gonna cause that problem before we get the jobs back.
For people that aren't very old, I just would hearken them back to the Jimmy Carter era where we had stagflation and the misery index. We can have both high unemployment and high inflation. So that is a possibility.
Yeah, I think the inflationary concerns are there, but they're segmented or fragmented. You see it pop up in different areas, but it's not as broad-based as most of the consumers are gonna would identify it as.
Okay, and then finally, as we wrap up this first half of the program, your best idea for a producer at this point besides getting in the field and planting a corn crop?
This is going to be a very volatile year, and I do think options to protect the bottom is the best way to go right now.
Well, first off, enjoy the Easter weekend and then come back next week kind of relaxed and ready to do it again, and we'll get a break in the weather one of these days to get some stuff done.
Yeah, with the potential for corn to be either $5 or $9 this fall and beans to be $12 or $20, I mean, really, if we have any kind of weather problems, we can't just do it the old-fashioned way and stick a stake in the ground and sell flat price. I think Mike's right. We have to use options to lock in floors, but give yourself that upside, because a year ago we thought $4 corn was a great sale, and here it is at $7. Now those $4 sales don't look so good, and it could be the same way with $6 corn this year. It sounds great, but if we have any kind of weather problems, that may not be so good.
You're listening to Agricultural Program. Programming from Illinois Public Media. You can visit us online anytime you'd like at willag.org. That's willag.org. There you'll find all kinds of agricultural programming, from our pre-opening market report to our closing market report each and every business day of the year, everything in between. In this program, Commodity Week, it's all free and all available for a download at willag.org.
I'm Steve Hilberg with the Midwestern Regional Climate Center, located at the Illinois State Water Survey in Champaign. Much colder and wetter weather took hold across Illinois this week, and it's a pattern we may be locked into for much of next week as well. Temperatures this week varied markedly across the state, ranging from near normal in southern Illinois to a whopping 13 degrees below normal in northern Illinois. Central Illinois managed to get a taste of warm weather on Tuesday in advance of the thunderstorms, but that warm air never made it to northern Illinois. It was cold enough this week to support snow in northeastern Illinois Sunday into Monday. 2 to 3 inches accumulated in northern Lake County. Precipitation in general is much above normal across all of Illinois this week. Several inches of rain fell in central Illinois, where thunderstorms prompted flash flood warnings in a number of counties. Severe thunderstorms plowed through central and south-central Illinois, spawning at least 2 and possibly 3 tornadoes and producing wind damage along their paths. Another wet week is ahead, although we could see a 2 to 3 day period of dry weather beginning about next Thursday. Showers and thunderstorms will be most widespread Monday and Tuesday, with rain tapering off as Wednesday progresses. Temperatures will likely be near to below normal next week, although a warming trend should kick in by the end of the week. For the Midwestern Regional Climate Center in Champaign, I'm Steve Hilberg.
Support for Commodity Week comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of 5 new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333. And by ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers, because everything they do starts with you.
This is the April 22nd edition of Commodity Week. I'm Todd Gleason. In studio with us, Bill Gentry. He's with Risk Management Commodities out of Lafayette, Indiana. Mike Georgie of Allendale from Mahomet, Illinois. And Greg Johnson of the Andersons from right here in Champaign County on the phone line with us. Joe Persaki with USDA NASS. And he's out east. Joe, thanks for taking the time with us today. We do appreciate that.
Sure, Todd. No problem. Always enjoy talking to you folks back at WIL Radio. It's a good service you guys provide.
Well, we're trying to provide some services, and we had an idea a couple of weeks ago after there were a bunch of these rumors that were floating around about what was happening in Washington, D.C., and the federal budget cuts, and USDA NASS thinking about whatever the rumors were saying they were going to think about, and suggested we might have a conversation with our panelists and you and our producers about what changes might be or could be made in the USDA reports, whether that be the grain stocks report, crop production reports, planting intentions reports, those sorts of things. So I asked you to write up a few questions for us. You did that, and we sent them out and got some responses. Can you let us know why it is that USDA NASS is looking at this idea at this point?
Well, always you know, we at NASS, we always kind of go through periodically and we do what's called a program review. And we've done this, you know, historically, you know, following the census of agriculture every 5 years. And one of the things that's coming out is, okay, who should we talk to? You know, trying to get out to a broader audience. And that was part of the USDA's Ag Advisory Committee on Ag Statistics that suggested try to, you know, try other venues, and then plus also our long-range plan that NASA is working on has a component, you know, trying to figure out, okay, what should we look like? What kind of reports should we be doing in the future? I mean, we've been doing a lot of these for a long time, and should we be doing something different? And that's kind of where we are right now.
So you sent a set of six questions that we here at willag.org sent not once but twice to our email list. There are about roughly 3,000 on that list. I got to tell you, Joe, that most of them are probably producers and a few traders and agribusiness folks. And I got one response. Thank you, John. And he'll want to know. And then I also sent it to our list of panelists and analysts, and that doesn't go too deep, but there are 25 or 30 on that. And I got about a 30% response on that. So we'll send those on to you, Joe, in their entirety. But I guess it shows maybe that producers either, one, aren't sure what those reports are and how to respond to them, or they were awfully busy in the field. We know the latter one is not the case. So your thought process here about trying to reach out to close the loop, I think is the way you say it, with producers is an interesting thought. But I don't know how to do that. And maybe we need to have producers, if they can, they can call us or drop us an email and let us know what they think that might be.
Because that's, you know, that's the toughest thing, you know, Todd, because, you know, here, you know, you have your panel of, you know, your panel in there in the studio with you, and they are, I use the word, savvy data users. They know about NASS databases. They know our reports. But where does the data come from? It comes from the producers themselves. Oh, and, you know, it's like when we call or send something in the mail, or like you said, you send them an email and ask them for stuff. And it's like, well, I hear this on WIL radio. I don't need to respond to you. You know, and it's like, well, okay, you provide, you being Mr. Farmer, Ms. Farmer, you provide the information to us. We compile it. We look at it. We compare it. Then we publish it. And then, you know, the various outlets, you know, ag media and such, disseminate it. Then you have all this other group looking at the data and making recommendations, just like, you know, the folks in the audience today making recommendations, what they believe to be the process. But, you know, how do we make that connection with the farmers back to the reports that come out on specific days? And that's a tough question.
Right, and then can we go through some of the questions that you asked, and we'll get the panelists involved here. So you ask a series of questions. There are six of them, with a couple of them that have several parts. We'll start at the beginning, and you want to know what the need is for state level crop estimates.
For the you know, like the folks in the studio there. I mean, do you need, like, say for corn? You use corn, for example. Do you need the state-level forecast when we go through the growing season? Do you need the state-level acreage, or could you just use the national level? I'm just looking for, you know, possibilities, questions, or what do you need to do your jobs?
Well, Joe, I guess I'll start here. I think I think we need the state levels. We need the state acres, because that is that very much depends on what the total is. You know, if every week we get if we get the state numbers, we can tell from year to year what the average is, and we can tell if Illinois is in a drought, then. And Nebraska isn't, that's still going to change things. So I think them numbers definitely there to go by the state is definitely needed for to get an accurate end reading.
And then part two of that was, is it okay if we just do the top 10 states as opposed to...
Yeah, right. Do we need all the states, or just, you know, because the top 10 states, that's about 85 or 86% of the production.
Yeah. I guess from our vantage point, you know, the top 10 states would probably be adequate, but make sure that you do include the additional states or that additional production in maybe a more general number. The big thing that we were a little bit concerned about is if you have, you know, all other states as a category, does that become a fudge factor for the numbers, kind of like a residual in your monthly reports. We're all very critical, and that's just one thing we're a little bit concerned about.
Yeah, because that's a good point. You know, because the idea would be is, like when we come around to the December, that end of year report that comes like on January 12th, we would have all states in there. But you know, during the forecast season, do you need to see every state, or can we, you know, because like for data collection and sampling, I could get by with a smaller sample if
certainly.
I just have this big group of all other states.
Certainly,
yeah, I would say we need at least the 10.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So here's one interesting comment, and I'll forward all of these to you, but. The comment is, what are the implications for things like crop insurance if you do just the top 10 states and the acre program, which are driven by county yield data?
Right. At the end of the season, we would still do, like in December, like I said, we would do, this is the end of year production for all the states, again, just stay with corn, and then we would generate county estimates, you know, based on that end of year production. So that still the county estimates would be available then. But this, I was thinking more during a growing season and then, say, with prospective plannings and then maybe with the June acreage report.
Right. And then there was one other thing. Wanted to know how the state ratings are weighted if acreage data isn't available.
Okay, because we would still have the acreage data available
right. To
us. We just wouldn't, you know, it just wouldn't be available later on. You know, what I'm saying is when we do through the growing season, all you would see, we would still have the acres to weight things together, but we just wouldn't sample for yield. We would have a smaller sample to do yield in these, not the 10 states, the other states.
Right. So let's skip 2 for the moment and go to 3 because you mentioned the crop progress reports. And in your question, you just say, is this just nice to have? So is it just nice to have, Craig?
No, I think it moves the market. There are some years, last year, for example, where, maybe the correlation between, percentage of good to excellent didn't exactly correlate with the final yield. And there's variables that can be explained for that. But in general, I think, the better the crop is throughout the growing season, it does relate to the final yield. And I think that is a very important number. So I would love to, continue to see those numbers being reported for the top states.
Well, and one of our views was, we've come to a point where the content may not be as representative of the crop as we would like it to be. The timeliness, the way it's presented, everybody knows where it is. So the infrastructure of transmitting the information is fantastic. The problem is, what's that really got to do with the end result as far as crop size, crop development? What kind of observations are really represented in those crop progress numbers, especially in mid-season?
Yeah, and that's the question, that I ask the staff, because as you know, with crop progress, it's a voluntary response survey from a group of experts. Now, what does that mean? I mean, it could be ag VOAG teachers, it could be someone working in an ag bank, FSA employees. I mean, it's a wide gambit of individuals, mm-hmm. and their interpretation of good to excellent or good is this, and then what's the percent. Percent harvested or percent planted, what does that mean? I had a good reporter in Iowa that would run the same route every Sunday afternoon. And it would, based on that, that's how he would get his change. Now, I'm not sure everyone does that.
Mm-hmm. All right, so one of the interesting responses that came back, and I think you alluded to this earlier on, because you were asked about the middle of the year. Maybe you can divide this crop progress report up for me, because really it's made up of condition of the crop and then what stage the crop is in, those two things, right?
That's true. There's two pieces, right? It's the condition, crop condition, and then you have what percent at certain stages, because like right now, what percent of the corn crop is planted, and then you get to wheat, what percent of the crop is headed and so forth, and moving on.
Yeah, so this particular response says they really like the weekly crop progress reports from April 1st to June 1st, and then again from September 1st to November 1st. And that those would be okay if they just coincided with the 10 key states, I suppose, but not the summer months. If things needed to be cut, I guess.
Uh-huh.
And wasn't really all that sure that the silking and setting pod reports were all that important, but certainly that the planting and harvest percentages to them were important.
Well, this I would say the silking is usually not a factor. Last year it wasn't, but if you're planting late and we're worried about an early frost or a normal frost with a late planting date, then those numbers may become a little bit more important.
Well, and even in this particular situation this year, the emergence factor with the coolness that we're seeing and the moisture, you know, the emergence is going to be pretty important. But the other thing, too, is when you get to that middle part of the season, are we seeing pollination take place early? Are we seeing it take place late? When is it corresponding with weather patterns? I think that would probably leave you in a pretty big void of information.
If you limited that middle piece.
Yes.
Yeah. It's always one of the, it's really interesting, you know, when you start talking, it's like, it just depends, you know, on some of these things.
Well, and I think that comes to the scouting process. I mean, have you got somebody that's really in the know as far as agronomically where a corn or a bean or a wheat plant is established, growing, progressing? Is it moving forward or backwards? Can you tell that from the road? Can you go out in the field and make a more educated observation? I know that takes talent and takes time, but that's probably in some way, shape, or form what would improve the product a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. I understand what you're saying. Yeah.
Well, I think, you know, the weekly crop progress, I think something that everybody's going to be watching this year is the 1.3 million acres you've added in North and South Dakota is, are they going to be planted in a timely manner? Or are they not? And they're going to put it into numbers to see what the yields are going to be. And, I mean, that's very important on a week-to-week basis on where we're going to be in the end.
And so bottom line, it's really interesting because, you know what, like what Todd said, you know, the rumors about, you know, the USDA eliminating crop progress. Well, I thought the world was coming to an end in Washington.
I didn't say that. No, I avoided saying that.
Oh, no,
actually.
I know you did, but there was other folks in the media, and I had some good people that worked for me made comments, and it was not a good week.
Well, that's why you enjoy Washington, dude.
It's always interesting. Every day, something new.
Yeah, so go back to two now, which deals with
grain stocks.
Grain stocks.
You know, for the industry, let's use the word, you know, the industry as a whole, agriculture. You know, with grain stocks, are the individual state level, you know, values for corn, beans, are they important, or is it just, do we just need the national level of stock?
I think it's pretty important that you have those regional levels or the state levels because, let's say, in keeping in with corn for your example, let's say Ohio starts to get in a drought stress environment, you can start to anticipate that some of your Illinois or Indiana corn in particular is going to get pulled to the east instead of maybe to the south towards a river market or something like that, so you can adjust for the dynamics and also make at least reasonable basis expectations. You know, I'm not a basis expert by any stretch,
okay.
But you still have to have a feel. Is this area going to have a perpetual floor underneath it at some level? And this area is really going to have to push really hard if they're going to procure their normal amount.
In my thoughts, we don't need the state levels. I'm happy with the U.S. grain levels because basically what we use it for is to judge what we've used in the last quarter, what we've used in the last month. So, I mean, I don't think people care where the corn is specifically. It's how much we have.
Well, I, from an elevator's point of view, I would say that is important for people that are trying to set basis levels. If you're just looking at futures prices, you probably don't care about where it is. Like Mike said, you know, if it's in if it's in Illinois or Ohio or Iowa, he doesn't care. But since we're an elevator in Illinois, we kind of care how much corn is in Illinois. So I think it does have an effect on basis levels.
I think the responses across the board did mention basis as an important part of the state level. Or an important reason for having the state level there, but that in general if you're going to do something, the national would be fine, but they sure would like to have the state to help set the basis levels.
You know, and then, yeah, because the other question would be, what about the, you know, if you pick the numbers, it's the top 10, top 15 states, would that make a difference too? You know, because you start getting, you know, get beyond that, I mean, you start getting very small levels of production and storage.
Well, then you'd have to start looking at where your largest areas of consumption are, which is not as transparent to some of us.
Okay, that's a good observation, yes.
Okay, now, the monthly price report, question number four, is it used by you? This question on most of the returns was not answered.
because that's the question. That monthly price report comes out, on the grain side, we ask, it ties to grain elevators. We ask about how many bushels of picked commodity corn, let's say, how many bushels were actually the transaction that changed ownership, and then what was the dollars. And then that average, that when we come up with a season average or market year average price, back in the days when we had countercyclical payments, it made a bigger difference because that was what FSA used as the trigger. If it was below the loan rate, then when there was a payment. If it was above, there wasn't. So that's one use. And it's starting to come into play with the new acre program as well, with this, with the revenue products that they're talking about there. So I was just, curious because, we always have questions about, okay, what about the price report? Is the mid-month price, useful? That, if no one responds, that leads one to wonder about its usefulness.
Yeah, I think that, this time of year when 85% of the corn has been marketed, even that last 10 or 15% getting sold at a very high price has a minimal impact on that overall price. So, yeah, that's probably, if there has to be something that has to be cut, that might be, I guess I would be okay with that one before any of the other ones that we've talked about.
And from our chair, the same holds true. We use it as a barometer, so to speak. So how much has been marketed, what levels. I mean, when you look at it from your perspective, you can publish a number within a band that makes reasonable sense. That we look at it as a glance just to see what kind of progress is being made. But does it really impact decisions? Probably not.
Yeah, I'd agree there because we don't use it in any kind of marketing decisions. I don't think the market uses it as any kind of influence on pricing, so I don't think it's that much needed.
Joe, maybe you could survey the farmers when you're asking them this question as far as how much they have sold, what percentage, because Todd always asks us that, and we have to go out and survey our farmers, and we're not real sure if that number is entirely accurate or not. So maybe surveying a bigger sample would be interesting to see.
Because that's always the question I get in D.C. That's the same one, is what percent of the crop has been marketed? It's like, because you can look at, like at interior Illinois grain prices, what AMS publishes and then what Iowa publishes. And then when our monthly price comes around and you say, okay, well, what was actually, changed hands or whatever, say it's like five-something versus cash price of seven-something, say, well, a lot of that was forward contracted.
Mm-hmm.
And it's already been priced, and so you can have $20 a bushel for corn, but there might not be any left.
Exactly.
And so let's move to question five, the impact of changing some monthly reports to quarterly reports. These are things like cattle on feed, chicken and eggs. There was a wide variety of answers on this one. Most of them thought quarterly reports would be okay, although they thought that because poultry changed so rapidly, it might need to come more often, and that because it's such a large factor in feed usage.
Yeah, because we do like weekly broilers. Always ask my unit that takes care of the poultry stuff. Okay, now weekly broilers, can you do that monthly? And it's the same thing that you answered. Man, because it changes so fast, because they can, do the sets and hatches, they can turn things around, and then the expected, inventory size coming down the pipe can change so rapidly.
And one of the things that we thought is look at each individual commodity and see what is its cycle, its life cycle or its maturity cycle, and then make the reports representative of that. So you could keep the poultry, let's say, on a weekly basis. You could put your hogs on a monthly basis and maybe crops on a monthly basis, but extend some of the other things like cattle and make them only quarterly or something like that.
Yeah, because I was just curious about that because, there's always been a push or comments that I hear, and it's when you talk to different sectors that we have to have the cattle on feed report every month. And it's like, I don't know, because according, based on how you use it, is that necessary?
Exactly.
Well, my opinion is I think you need to keep almost everything quarterly. I mean, it's just like the cattle on feed report today. People use it. How many are in there? How many have been marketed? It's important, and it is a market mover, and it tells us what has moved. So, quarterly on that, I think would I would prefer to stay monthly.
Minimum.
Yeah, and I think you brought up a little bit, a good point too is who's using which reports. The one question was, you know, which ones could possibly be eliminated. That's a very difficult one to answer from behind this desk because we only use a fraction of the reports available to us, but that doesn't represent the whole of agriculture.
And that's the thing I've been running into. It's like, well, how do I know? Because if I talk to hog producers or people in the hog industry, they want hog reports. I talk to people in the dairy industry, it's like, well, I don't necessarily need to know anything about catfish, you know?
Yep.
And it's like, keep my stuff, but get rid of everybody else.
Well, I've got people that have answers.
Oh, they do? Well, good.
Let's see. Here's a couple. Let's see. The must-haves, the June acreage, the grain stocks, the crop conditions, crop production, and at least quarterly livestock inventory estimates. Could live without the prospective plantings report. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, okay.
And the August crop production forecast.
Well, I've heard that one before, too.
Yeah.
And I always made a comment on the August crop. That's an interesting one because that's been a deliberation that we've had for a long time. And I said, okay, suppose NASS does not do the August crop production report. What would happen? Now, you folks are obviously aware of the WASDE reports that come out from the World Board. Okay, do they not do a May 1 forecast for corn and beans, a June 1 forecast for corn and beans, a July 1 forecast for corn and beans for yield? Well, what do you think would happen if NASS didn't do the August crop report?
Well, the problem is you're probably switching methodology and observation points as well as some interpretation. And switching that kind just from you being a statistician, when you change your data set and your procedures and then publish it to the public, the response and the interpretation is going to be exceptionally different.
Exactly. So that was, I mean, because like I said, the World Board would put out an August yield. I'm just telling they would. They would, because they have to do their balance sheet. They would. And I love those guys. I do talk. Actually, I talked to them today.
Well,
we have some interesting discussions.
Well, some of the other things, you may put the reports together. Like you got the dairy products report and the milk production report. You
mm-hmm.
can put them two together.
Okay.
You know, I mean, rice stocks could be with the grain report. Different things like that could be put together, I think, rather than come out in two different times of the month.
Well, that's I've asked those questions, too, and we've always done it that way. So, so it's like, well, I don't know if I like that. That's why I'm doing these little road shows, asking questions. So, Todd, how much time do we have left? I have a question for them.
Sure, go ahead. No, well, we're 42 minutes into a 29-minute show.
Oh, okay. So you're cutting it. Okay, good.
No, the whole thing's going to – it'll all hit the podcast, so it's
good.
Perfectly fine.
Hey, I was just curious. You know, Todd, you and I have talked about this, about the – you've heard about this, the Census Bureau, you know, eliminating what's called the current industrial reports, and that includes, you know, for ag, that includes the oils, soybean crush, and then the other oils, and then there's the wheat flour, you know, the wheat millings. And there's two oil reports, and not so much for the Midwest, but there's the cotton stocks reports. And I was just curious, how much are you guys aware of that and that sort of thing?
Not especially. And as far as the crush numbers, are you talking about the NOPA and the census crush numbers?
Okay, right, because the NOPA, that's separate. That's from the industry. But the census,
mm-hmm.
the census numbers, there's some discussion about that going away.
I don't know that we would probably miss it, but it's probably nice to have a comparison. It's almost like the EIA and the API numbers for crude.
Mm-hmm.
You know that they're different, and you know they have their idiosyncrasies, but checks and balances are still typically a good thing, even if all you do is average them together.
Yeah. And then what about like for flour, for the wheat grind?
That's off my.
Because that's not because you guys are corn and bean guys.
Yeah. We're lucky to get the livestock.
I was just curious because I know, like, for the World Board with their balance sheets and stuff, I mean, they use that census crush number in there. And I was just curious if it was, just the thoughts on that. So that's fine.
Anything else?
Just want to thank you guys for taking the time to chat with me. Because, that's how you get information.
And we, I would say, since you came out to WILL, though, and really appreciated you doing that a couple years ago, we've really done a hard push to tell all our guys that are getting your surveys to fill them out and be truthful, because it really does make a difference. Getting the right answer takes the right questions and the right inputs.
Because I appreciate it, because that's absolutely true. I mean, again, that's how I talk about this closing the loop thing. Well, mm-hmm. How does it impact me? Well, the advice that as a service back to the producers, I could do a better job if I have good information. And where does the good information come from? It comes from you, the farmer.
Well, let's close with that point. How good are your stats?
How good are my stats?
The stats you have always have an error.
Oh yeah, sure,
code
sure.
In them. So how good are they?
Oh, okay, yeah, okay. At the national level, it's called a coefficient of variance. It's within 1%, easy. And then at the state level, like you take the big states. This big states like, the Iowa's, Illinois for corn and beans, it's probably within, in our internal documents, we need to be within 5%, and we're generally better than that. Like, I know in Iowa and Illinois, we're probably within 2%, within every month based on the data we have. Now, during the growing season, like last year, oh, jeepers, there's all kinds of things that impacted from month to month, but any one month, there's a little bit of variation that it possibly has. So it would argue that it's very good on the big states. Now you get to, like, say, corn in Alabama. It's quite variable because, one, you don't have that many corn producers, and the yields are quite variable that will come back. It just depends, on the farmers and how familiar they are with corn. So I would argue overall I'm very happy, but we could always do better, meaning the more producers that respond, the better everything is. If I had 100% response rate, I would be tickled pink, but I know everybody doesn't respond. I mean, that's just the way it is.
Joe, thanks so much for taking the time with us today.
Well, hey, thank you, Todd. Thanks for inviting me, and everybody else, all you farmers out there, it's planting season. It's another season. Be careful, because sometimes bad things happen, but I hope not. And hang in there. It's going to dry out and be warm someday.
Indeed it is. Thanks much, Joe.
Thanks.
Joe Persaki is with USDA NASS. Our guest in studio have been Bill Gentry. He's with Risk Management Commodities out of Lafayette, Indiana. Mike Georgie of Allendale from Mahomet, Illinois. And Greg Johnson of the Andersons from right here in Champaign County. You can always write us a note at willagstaff@illinois.edu or to me directly at tgleason@illinois.edu. If you'd like to fill out this survey, we'll forward it right on back to Joe at USDA in Washington, D.C. That's this April 22nd edition of Commodity Week. I'm Todd Gleason.